This week, the Dow blasted higher by nearly 500 points. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, here with you on this September 13th broadcast. Now that the precious metals rebound is slowing, some investors are growing a bit concerned that the advance is in jeopardy. Goldman Sachs christened it a bear market this week, calling for $1,000 gold and perhaps even lower. Money manager Peru Saxena joins me in a lively discussion on the sector. The former gold bull turned bear and I try to find common ground in the debate. Peru is ready to return to the bullish camp, but not until key levels are surpassed, so you'll want to be sure to stay tuned for this thought-provoking dialogue. Then Gerald Celente and I take a look at the global geopolitical situation. He's still convinced that gold is the best unadulterated investment for every portfolio. Then Robert Ian kicks a game-clinching field goal with his latest editorial. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the Market Weatherman Report. Well, after two solid months of excellent market weather, cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals exchanges this week. Investors locked in profits ahead of next week's FOMC meeting on speculation of tapering by Fed officials. Plus, news of easing tensions between Syria and the U.S. took some of the safe haven appeal out of the market. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold dropped about $63. That's about 5%, finishing the trading session at $13.27 on Friday. Silver dropped about $1.50, 6.8%, finishing at $22.23. Silver is now backdated through December of 2015, while gold is backdated through June of 2015 on the NYMEX. On a more positive note, one top market analyst said that on this five-year anniversary of the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, gold is still higher by 73% and silver by 100%. Furthermore, despite sluggish price action this week, silver is still up by 22% and gold by 13% from their reaction summer lows. According to GFMS forecasts, the yellow metal will climb above $1,500 in early 2014. Meanwhile, the top story impacting the markets was speculation that the Fed will curtail QE purchases at the next FOMC meeting slated for next week. The Fed will decide to cut monthly purchases of treasuries, dropping it to $35 billion from $45 billion, and keep mortgage bond buying at $40 billion at the next September 17th meeting. According to experts, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke suggested on June 19th that the program will be wound up completely by the summer of next year. However, most of the upcoming taper talk appears to have been baked into the cake. Goldman expects the Fed to curtail purchases by $10 billion a month. So what's driving the taper expectations? Well, the number of Americans seeking jobless benefits fell below 300,000. That's the first time in 7 years. Initial jobless claims dropped by 31,000 to a seasonally adjusted 292,000, according to a Labor Department report on Thursday. Dr. Bernanke is expected to retire within the next few months. And according to a report in a Japanese newspaper, the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers will be nominated as the new Federal Reserve Chairman. Still, the White House refused to confirm the story, noting that no official decision has yet been made by the president regarding the next Fed chairman. Another prime contender for the Fed chair position, Fed Vice Chair Janet Yellen. While both are known for their dovish ways, Janet Yellen is viewed as more accommodating. Either way, it's likely that gold-friendly monetary policies will persist at least until the end of the current administration's tenure. In geopolitical news, tensions between the U.S. and Syria subsided somewhat this week on news that envoys from the U.S. and Russia met to discuss the surrender of Syrian chemical weapons. Over the past month, the precious metals benefited from safe haven buying in anticipation of a regional conflict. West Texas Intermediate crude oil also recoiled from the highest point in 2 years on the news. Still, price action suggests that investors have yet to discount the possibility of increased tensions, so stay tuned. Bottom line on the precious metals. Well, the selling was intense this week. So far, it appears to be little more than a reaction amid a powerful rebound rally off the lows that I believe will hold for many years to come. For the rest of this report, please log into your AlphaStocks newsletter account. Moving on to Wall Street, visibility was virtually unlimited over the equities markets for the second week running. The markets exploded higher on much better than expected domestic employment numbers. By Friday's closing bell on the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones Industrials added almost 500 points, 453, 3%, finishing at 15,376. The S&P 500 picked up 32 points, 2%. Ending at 1687, and the NASDAQ picked up 62, about 1.7% for the week, ending at 3722. Meanwhile, the Institute for Supply Management Factories Index showed U.S. manufacturing improved at the best clip in 2 years. In another reading, almost 90% of the economy posted the best output in about a decade. But on Friday, economic data disappointed. The University of Michigan Thomson Reuters Consumer Sentiment Index dropped to the lowest point in about 6 years. Retail sales recorded the worst advance of the year, perhaps offsetting a bit of taper expectations. Elsewhere, the TJX Companies operates an off-price apparel and home fashions retailer in the United States and internationally. According to DCF analysis, TJX shares remain undervalued by over 10%. They are attempting to break out to multi-year highs with a target potential of about $60. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the fear index indicates that investors remain surprisingly fearful despite this breakout in the NASDAQ, the S&P, and a nearly 500-point advance on the Dow this week. I think this is a big plus from a contrarian perspective. For the rest of this report and next week's forecast and stock picks, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up, more GoldSeek.com radio with the original doomsday prepper Gerald Celente and money manager Peru Saxena. So stay with us here for these must-hear interviews at GoldSeek.com radio. Well, this week, Congress gave approval for a small-scale military operation in Syria, but some analysts are worried that a full-scale military conflict with the U.S. could be imminent. Gerald Celente joins me with his take on the situation and how it might affect the markets. He's the director of the Trends Research Institute. His team produces the Trends Journal. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, some media sources are suggesting that a showdown between the U.S. and Syria could lead to a potential conflict there in the Middle East, another front, if you will. Unlike some of their neighbors, I think you'd agree that Syria has a formidable military resources and presence. And sometimes these conflicts can get out of hand. Any comments?
Well, you go back and look at our top trend for 2013 in the Trends Journal. It was war, and we've been writing about the lead-up to this for a long time. And writing about that lead-up in previous Trends journals, we kept showing how the information coming out about what Syria was doing and who was involved has really been distorted to make the case for an attack rather than making it case for peace. And so I watched, for example, the recent Senate foreign intelligence hearings, and it was a disgrace listening to this charade that was going on. It reminded me of being in high school and listening to a principal and the students babble on. And then there was a report this past week in the Wall Street Journal analyzing what the so-called evidence is and really what it means, and it's two very different things. And the Wall Street Journal punched holes in just about all of it. So then when you see the report that came out from the Senate panel after the hearing, what they did was they changed the focus to, quote, change the momentum on the battlefield. So all of a sudden now, America is becoming involved in another foreign entanglement after losing Iraq, losing Afghanistan, causing a civil war in Libya, and now they're going to fix Syria? Of course there's going to be more destabilization. Oh, by the way, conveniently out of the news, hey, look what's going on over there in Egypt. Doesn't even make the newspapers anymore. And bloodshed continues, riots ensue, and destabilization is at levels that have never been seen before in recent history.
And, you know, we're seeing record oil prices, some sources suggesting that we might even revisit those 2008 levels that were staggering, you know, up to $147 a barrel for West Texas Intermediate crude. That has a tendency to, you know, put downward pressure on economic output, as essentially everyone is paying more at the pumps to get to and from work and wherever else they need to travel, as well as our transportation systems. Any thoughts on how this developing situation in the Gulf there might affect it?
Well, that's part of it. The other part is, and you pointed out, I mean, we're looking at a Syria country of 20 million people. Let's suppose your family was wiped out and you lost everything that you had. You think you want to see revenge attacks? So now put this into perspective, Chris. Go back to this past April, and there was the Boston Marathon bombing. They closed down 100 square miles to hunt for a 19-year-old kid that was hiding in a boat. 100 square miles. Business stopped. A state of siege ensued. Now imagine, suppose there's a revenge attack at a 9/11 scale. Suppose there's a dirty bomb, for example, that would go off in San Francisco, or a suitcase-sized nuke, or biological warfare. This country goes on stop. And suppose the same thing happened in France or one of America's other allies. It'll destroy the economy. You have to understand. You don't have to understand. I say that, you know, just in putting it into perspective. I want to make this 100% clear. The United States military has not won a war since World War II. They lost Korea. They lost Vietnam. They lost Iraq. They lost Afghanistan. They destroyed Libya, civil war ensues, and now they're going to fix Syria? And the other level of hypocrisy, by the way, is all of this, oh my God, he used chemical weapons, and essentially, ostensibly 1,300 people have been killed. And we don't know who did what, by the way. I don't believe any of the information, unless you believe, remember the Maine, the Gulf of Tonkin incident that didn't happen, or the weapons of mass destruction, then you would take everything that they're saying at face value. Be that as it may, if you want to talk about hypocrisy and using weapons of mass destruction, hey, how about a couple of atom bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Oh, you like that Agent Orange that they sprinkle throughout Vietnam, or that napalm? What about all that white phosphorus and depleted uranium the United States has been using and has used in Iraq and Afghanistan and in other countries? Oh, Israel included, by the way, with the white phosphorus. And how about also what we're seeing going on if you kill somebody with carpet bombs or buster bunking bombs? What's the difference? Dead is dead. And to make all this thing about, oh, they use sarin gas, you know, how World War II that is, or World War I, and when you're using all these sophisticated weaponries. Hey, a drone is okay. You could kill with drones, but no unofficial FDA-approved chemical weapons. Oh, by the way, 1,400 dead in Egypt over the last 2 weeks. That's okay. They killed them with bullets. You can't kill them with gas.
You talk about our failure, you might say, to regulate our military efforts. And I'd like to go back to, you mentioned the last war that we really won, and that was World War II. And you might recall how we rebuilt the Axis powers, Italy, Germany, Japan. We helped rebuild. And as a result, the world looked at us and said, has there ever been a nation so benevolent that they actually defeat a power, and instead of horrible reparations that we saw during the Versailles Treaty, we actually rebuilt these nations. Now, fast forward to today, and unlike the little mini-conflict we actually won with Storm and Norman Schwarzkopf, the four-day war, that was maybe a model that we need to look back to. A four-day war, we went in, we got business taken care of, and then we pulled out instead of trying to micromanage the scenario. Any comment?
Well, yes, my comment is, I'm speaking now from Colonial Kingston, New York. As a matter of fact, tomorrow marks the 236th year that the New York State was actually formed, right here in Kingston, the first capital of New York State, in 1777. It was on September 6, 1777. And I'm reminded, of course, about the Founding Fathers, and General Washington among them, who in his farewell address warned about becoming involved in foreign entanglements. It's not our business. And as I'm here in Colonial Kingston, New York, and I see the difficulties that this city is having with its number of its population, I want to see my money going to restoring Kingston or Cleveland or Detroit or Camden. Not, $40 million a day, they're estimating, just in some aspects of a war against Syria. So this, to me, is way out of balance. And there is no such thing as going in and getting out, because if you look back to 1991, the rest of the 90s were involved in a war with Iraq. People forget the no-fly zones and bombs over Baghdad every time. It was a wag-the-dog moment every couple of months. So, no, I'm totally opposed to it as being an American and believing in the foundations of this country. And secondly, to see the lunacy, all anyone has to do, again, at that Senate hearing and listening to them babble on. Oh, and by the way, talking about babbling on, I am sick and tired. I don't want to hear it again. That if only women were in charge, there would be no war. I heard Barbara Boxer going on and on about the need for war. I heard this woman, the senator from New Hampshire, DeHaan, I believe her name is, or something like that. And then I saw that clip of Nancy Pelosi babbling on about a five-year-old grandson and what he had to say about the Syrian war. And I'll tell you why she was quoting the five-year-old grandson, because that's the mind of these people. They got the mind of five-year-olds. There's not a man or woman among them. Where are all the people saying no more to war? How much more money and men do we have to lose, and how many more people does America have to kill before they stop this madness? And here's my United General Salenti's four rules of peace. You're the commander-in-chief. You want to take out Assad? Great. Go take him out. Hey, they just found the bones of King Richard III recently. He got killed in the Battle of the Roses. I loved it, the War of the Roses. And they found him under a parking lot. That's how important he was. So when the king died, the war ended. And anybody out there that wants to support the war, send your kids, send yourself, send your money, send your wife. Go do the fighting. Keep me out of it. And number three, when they retaliate, don't go, oh, they hate our freedom and liberty, and they're terrorists. No, it's payback. The golden rule, do unto others you have them do unto you. So again, this is all very clear. If everything is in place, if you want this war, you pay for it, you go fight it, and keep me out of it. It's going to be another losing battle. Nothing will be accomplished. And I listen to these people on the Senate hearing again. Well, we have every contingency in place to make sure that if the first contingency doesn't work, the second one will.
I'd like to touch on a couple of key anecdotes here. Firstly, you talk about this idea that war is good. It reminds one of George Orwell's 1984, war is peace and endless war. But that takes me back to the 1990s with General Schwarzkopf. If you've had a chance to read his book, it's really quite illuminating. He was one of these amazing folks who actually fought in Vietnam, and he was the type of commander who would run back through open machine gun fire to pick up one of his wounded comrades. And this actually happened. He ran through a minefield one time, not knowing whether he would lose a leg or a limb, and carried a wounded soldier back to the helicopter. He earned several medals just for that one event. And the reason I mention this is that when he talked about his tenure there at taking our troops in on that four-day, 100-hour mini battle or war in the early 90s, he talks about how he hates war. And he knows the horror of it, and not get entangled in one of these 10-year or longer Vietnam-like scenarios where you could arguably say we're in currently in the Middle East, a quagmire.
And it wasn't like I was intelligent enough to know that they lied us into it. There was no Gulf of Tonkin incident as they reported it. It was a total lie. I was just a young kid, you know, 18 years old, and I couldn't imagine me in a foreign country with a lot of weight on my back getting shot at. There are some guys like Schwarzkopf that like that trip. And what did he do? We killed 3 million people over there? For what? For a lie? And now we're doing business with the Vietnamese? And I see Hillary Clinton over there when she was Secretary of State saying how we're going to defend the Vietnamese against the Chinese in their dispute over these islands? The whole war thing is a big lie. What? Look, listen to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, leaving office, five-star general, supreme commander of the Allied forces, and he warns the American people that the military-industrial complex is taking over, robbing us of the future of the genius of the scientists, the sweat of our labors, and the future of our nation. And look at the future of our nation throughout the Cold War and all these wars. Look at how this country is going downhill so quickly. Look at the gap between the rich and the poor. Look at the wages that people are not making. Look at how 97% of the jobs that are being created are part-time jobs, Chris. This whole war thing is draining the morality, lifeblood, and life out of this country. That was Schwarzkopf's trip. I'm totally against. Look, I'm not a pacifist. I'm a second-degree close combat practitioner. If anybody tries to do anything to me, I will do everything I have to do to stop them, and if I need to kill them, if they're trying to kill me, I will. I'm not a pacifist. I mind my own business. I love this language. Militants attack U.S. base in Afghanistan. Militants attack U.S. base. What if this was reversed? Would it be Afghan militants attack
Afghan base in Alabama, in Birmingham, Alabama?
This is sickness to me. This is total sickness. It's a delusion. And I'm telling you, all you have to do is watch the players. This guy Corker, what a corker he is, shooting his little mouth off. I went through the list of all these guys at that Senate hearing. A bunch of chicken hawks and draft dodgers. Every one of these loudmouths, this Representative Engel we have over here in New York. And all they want to do is go fight, go lead the charge. I don't want you taking my money. And that's the way I look at it. I want every cent of my money staying in the United States. And these people are now taking us to another losing disaster. And worse than that, as I wrote in the Trends Journal, continue to write and have been writing over the years, they're leading us into World War III. And you know that saying by Einstein, I don't know how the Third World War will be fought, but I know the fourth will be fought with sticks and stones.
Exactly, because we don't know just how things might get out of hand. You know, I was reading an interesting article the other day about World War II and the events that led up to the horrific nightmare of that terrible global war. All sides were convinced it would be just a quick little war, and before you know it, things will be settled and everything, peace will be. It was just their officials that threw them into the conflict. We never know just how things might unfold. You know, you have Russia and China that are adamantly opposed to any conflict with Syria. Of course, I'm sure you've read that Russia has armed Syria with many of their protective missiles, some of which have incredibly long range. Why do we want to antagonize the entire world? And, you know, that leads me back to your comments about George Washington. You know, he was one of the most failed commanders in world history. He lost virtually every conflict he ever went into in the French-American Indian War. Look at the American Revolution. We almost lost that as well. But so to hear someone like that say, we don't need to get entangled with these conflicts around the world.
And it's not only him, it's you go through all the founding fathers. They were all opposed to it. And here we are in the midst of it. Now, I ask you this question. You name me one great success that has come out of Washington when they've started, whether it's a war on drugs, a war in the Middle East, to fix education with their education czars. Name me one successful program that you could look at to Washington and say, wow, these are a bunch of intelligent people. I feel very confident that they know what they're doing. Tell me one.
It's hard. It's hard to do.
Maybe, no, tell me one.
Meals on Wheels, maybe? I love that program.
It's not, you know, it's more local.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a little thing.
No,
Losers.
Yeah.
They're losers.
No,
they can't
agree with you.
Balance the budget. Why would any self-respecting adult listen to what these people have to say? That's the way I look at it. And you know the motto taught to me by my dear father, may his soul rest in peace, think for yourself. And that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying you should think like this. As I see it, these guys and women are a bunch of losers. Leaders? They couldn't lead me across the street. And again, if they want to lead, lead the charge. Our forecast is this. If the United States goes to war with Syria, as I wrote in the Trends Journal that went out as the top trends for 2013, it's the beginning of the first great war of the 21st century.
Well, you know, there are some folks who are claiming that we're already in the early stages of World War III. You just don't declare war many times until long after the stage has been set and the chess pieces are already in motion.
Well, that's exactly it. That's what we've been writing about. And again, you know, I've been writing about this for a number of years. People waiting for an Archduke Ferdinand moment? You know, now it's official. You know, I mean, this thing is going on. Look, let's make this clear. There's a war in Syria, there's a war in Libya. There's a war in Yemen, there's a war in Bahrain, there's a war in Congo, there's a war in the Sudan. They're warring throughout many nations in Africa. There's civil wars going on, but they don't call them that. And those civil wars are what's going on in Greece and in Spain and in Portugal with this rampant unemployment levels, youth unemployment levels, likes of which have never been seen before. You have a civil war going on in Egypt. Oh, by the way, the United States government has still refused to call it a military coup over there in Egypt. I mean, it's just your imagination that guy Sisi is in charge over there, always wears that military uniform and those dark glasses that's right out of a comic book. That's only your imagination that the military overthrew it. Our government says it wasn't a military coup. So as you go around the world, you can see this destabilization, and then you start adding in the more economics into it, because that's really a lot of what goes on behind the scenes. And as you well know, being with Goldseek, you see what's going on in the emerging markets and how they've lost 11%, you know, they're down 11% this year already. And you see a currency crisis emerging with the Brazilian real, with the Indian rupee, with the Turkish lira, and on and on. You can see these currencies that are going through all these problems as all this hot money is drying up with the fear that interest rates are going up. So you're going to see more and more destabilization. And you know my saying, when all else fails, they take you to war. And that's what they're doing now.
I mean, it's a favorite tactic for supposedly pulling economies out of the quagmire because, well, folks start working and spills over into the economy. But in the final analysis, I stick with your earlier comments, and that is we don't need any part of it. The blowback from this one day will be simply more than this nation can manage. And as we wrap up here, any parting comments, any topics that you'd like to share as we close?
Well, I think it's very important what we're seeing now also with gold, you know, losing a lot of its strength recently that has gained, or some of its strength, and the fear, of course, with the pullback on tapering and stopping some of the hot money flowing in. I believe that they're not going to be able to taper too much, particularly now that they're saying in the emerging markets that the only way to save their failing currencies is to raise interest rates, so that their currencies aren't depreciated even more. Well, how do you raise interest rates in a declining economy without destroying the economy? So I think any kind of tapering, any type of pullbacks is only going to be temporary, because they're going to have to juice the economies with more hot money. And when that hot money flows in, gold goes higher.
No, exactly. You know, I think the markets have either factored it in or priced in most of the taper talk by now. And I think they're starting to look for future economic growth. And, you know, we're also seeing surprising growth out of China, unexpectedly strong economic numbers. The Eurozone looks like it might be finally turning the corner there in its recession. If you bring that all together, that economic improvement certainly could bode well for the precious metals after having such a difficult 2013 so far.
Well, actually, I see more instability, which is going to be stronger for gold. And I don't see I see the recovery. Yeah, and I see the recovery in Europe being temporary. And I know also that there's a huge debt bubble floating in China that's going to have to be addressed. And the government, despite their calls recently not to keep pumping in money, are doing so, and that's going to reverse as well. So I see more instability coming in the coming months, but I do see that they're going to try to do everything, both in the United States and in Europe, as we already saw at the ECB, keeping interest rates near their record lows, to keep the economy propped up to Christmas time, at least. And so that means more hot money flowing in, because they're not going to risk bringing down retail sales at a time when retail sales are already soft.
Very good. Well, low interest rates and safe haven buying, certainly music to the ears of our listeners today. Any contact information you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, you saw the New Trends Journal. It's history before it happens. It's all revamped, a whole new look. And I recommend that everyone consider it's money-back guarantee, nothing to lose, trendsjournal.com, trendsjournal.com. And I can guarantee you, Chris, it's the only magazine where you can read history before it happens.
Now, you've assembled a fantastic team and hat tip for such an economic think tank. You know, and that's what we really need. We need, I don't know, like a university of like-minded individuals who are thinking outside of the box and not afraid to push the limits, because that's the only way we get to the truth. Gerald Celente, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Chris.
Today's featured guest is a gold bull who appears to be wavering in his convictions. Peru Saxena is a founder of Peru Saxena Wealth Management in Hong Kong. Welcome, Peru Saxena.
Oh, pleasure to be here, Chris.
You know, I'd like to begin the discussion today, if we could, with the precious metals market of 2013 and a 12-year unbroken rally. You know, one would expect the reaction to be somewhat intense. We've certainly seen that. Complacency, euphoria turn into fear. Nevertheless, one down year does not a bear market make. I'm sure you'd agree. And as of last week, silver was higher by about 30% off the lows, gold by about 10%. Doesn't sound too much like a bear market, at least not the price action we would expect.
Well, Chris, pulled out of precious metals completely in September 2011. And for the last 2 years or so, we haven't had any positions in precious metals. You are absolutely right. I was a big gold bull between 2001 and 2011 September. But the charts, which we follow dispassionately and objectively, told us about 2 years ago that this thing was getting overdone and precious metals were due for a big pullback or a correction or a downtrend. You can call it whatever you want. And so far, it seems as though our assessment was correct. You are right. We've had a relief rally, a rebound rally in both gold as well as silver. However, I would beg to differ with you. I think that this is nothing more than a classic dead cat bounce. This is a relief rally within a larger downtrend. I believe the big picture trend for gold and silver has now turned to the downside. So I wouldn't be buying and rushing in and buying precious metals at this point. If gold and silver manage to clear the all-important 200-day moving averages as well as the huge overhead resistance, which is around $1,525 per ounce for gold and about $25.5 to $26 for silver, if prices manage to go above that, then I will be very happy to pay a higher price and go back on the uptrend. But for now, I think there's just too much overhead resistance. And if the dollar rallies here, then I think precious metals could be in for trouble.
The technical trader in me, the analyst, certainly concurs with your thoughts. Clearly resistance. Every analyst I've spoken to over the last 6 months would agree. We have that 1525 is extremely strong resistance and on gold and in the $26 to $30 range on silver, depending on which tea leaves you prefer to read. Price is the ultimate indicator. However, I think as we become more sophisticated as investors, we also begin to recognize the merits of fundamental analysis. And I'd like to fill the remainder of this discussion, if we could today, with just that. Many of the compelling arguments in support of gold and silver. So, for instance, you know, investors are a bit concerned that the Fed chairman Bernanke will reduce monthly Treasury purchases from around $45 billion a month down to $35 billion. While holding steady the mortgage-backed security toxic debt there, their purchases of around $40 billion. Now, that tapering would amount to about $120 billion a year, but still, the Fed would be adding almost $900 billion to its balance sheet, Peru. Now, given that the QE is the modern equivalent to wholesale money printing, and, you know, it's clearly bad news for the U.S. dollar, how do you justify your negative precious metals in lieu of this quantitative easing?
Well, Chris, everybody knows that the Fed has been engaged in quantitative easing for almost 3.5 years now, and all the data that you're alluding to is already in the price. Everybody knows that the Fed has been adding so much money, yet the hyperinflationists have been wrong. I was also caught wrong-footed initially when the QE started. I also wrongly believed that this would result in extreme inflation or hyperinflation. It hasn't happened. The reality is that even though the Fed is creating all this new money and it is buying assets or bonds, this money is not circulating in the economy. The problem is that the credit mechanism is broken. People in America are not borrowing this money, so this monetary base is not translating into credit growth and genuine money supply growth. And that's why we haven't had high inflation. That's why bond yields last year fell to record lows. That's why commodities are now in a severe downtrend, which also started in April 2011. And that's why inflation is non-existent. So unless this rampant credit growth starts again and the private sector credit mechanism is reestablished, until that point, I'm afraid the hyperinflationist view will be wrong, and there's not going to be any inflation or even high inflation, let alone hyperinflation, and precious metals will stay under pressure. So I agree with you partly in the sense that the Fed is creating new additional currency units or digital money these days and swapping it for assets. However, this is not transmitting into inflation because there is no credit growth. If this monetary base is still in the banks 5 years later and everybody starts borrowing money again and you have the multiplier effect and then you have fractional reserve banking and this monetary base explodes by 10 times, then you would have extreme inflation and possibly even hyperinflation. But at this point in time, there is no inflation, or at least there is no high inflation, and that's why commodities and precious metals, hard assets, are going down. And contrary to, you know, the belief of the gold bugs, the dollar has been in an uptrend for almost 2 years now, and I think it's going higher.
Let me outline a different scenario as I see it. I do take the opposite viewpoint with regard to inflation. The official inflation numbers, they are very, very different from the inflation of the typical American. Not only have they removed food and energy, but that's really just a tiny fraction. It's just a minuscule component, a modicum of what is behind the inflation numbers. In reality, one of the key components is housing. And as this housing market has collapsed here in the United States, and you know, as well as Europe, and it has virtually offset the official inflation figures. And education is in a huge bubble. We have enormous increases in tuition costs. As a student myself, I mean, I can attest to this fact. We've had a 50% increase in inflation in our tuition prices in just the past 3 years. Food across the board here, everyday people, an inordinate increase in their income for grocery expenses. We have roughly 48 million Americans now on the SNAP food stamp program. Because sure, you don't see inflation. The government is paying for the grocery bills. But as soon as that is pulled out, I really believe that your thesis is not backed up by empirical evidence, that there is little. I think you've seen the speculative excesses deflate out of the commodities markets. And as a result, we have drawn the wrong conclusion about inflation. There were huge hedge funds as well as speculators in those markets. And of course, that euphoria turned south and, well, folks went short. Now the pendulum has swung, I think, way to the other extreme. And inflation, well, it's back in play. Any thoughts?
Well, Chris, as much as I would like to agree with you, I have a different viewpoint. I think that inflation, as reported by the government, is low. And I don't necessarily believe the inflation numbers put out by the government, because everybody knows that they're all bogus. The reality is that the big institutions which control the money in the world, these guys, they pay attention to the headline numbers. So if the Fed says the inflation is less than 2%, everybody believes it. And in this market, as you know, perception is often more important than reality. And for me, as a trader, as an investor, I only care about my bottom line, how much am I up or down for the year? And whether you agree with it or not, the reality is, you know, for gold as well as silver, owning gold and silver and the related miners has been a disastrous trade over the last 2 years. Silver is down almost 60% from its all-time high. Gold is down about 25-30% from its all-time high. And the miners have been decimated over the last 18 months or so. So if you are looking at the academics and the empirical evidence, as you call it, I tend to agree with you. But the problem is, in this world, in the investment business, perception is everything. And I agree with you that there is inflation and the governments are lying. But the truth is that inflation has been with us since 1970-71, when gold was removed from the monetary system. However, if you remember what happened between 1980 and 2000, for 20 years, gold and silver fell, and they fell, and they fell for 20 years. So it was a horrible, horrible secular bear market for 20 years. And in that period, financial assets, productive assets such as stocks and real estate, assets which generate cash flow, they appreciated in value because money flew from unproductive assets, such as gold, towards productive assets. And then between 2000, 2001, and 2011, the same money came out of productive assets, i.e. stocks and real estate, etc., and came into the safety of gold, because people tend to hoard gold as money. When times are tough, when the economies are looking shaky, people turn towards gold, and that's why gold flourished in the last decade. Now, the way I look at the world, I see that the U.S. housing market is bottomed out already. Housing is recovering. And if history is any guide, if you look at a 100-year cycle for U.S. housing, you will note that after a 7 or 8 year cycle, prices fall for 3 to 4 years, and then they rally again for several years. So I think we're in the early stages of a housing recovery in the U.S. Things are bad in Europe, but I think we've gone past the puke point in Europe. So I think things are gradually going to get better in Europe as well. So if you have the developed economies gradually healing and improving, and if the Fed starts tapering, that will be bullish for the world's reserve currency. That will be bullish for the U.S. dollar. And under that scenario, if interest rates also start gradually creeping up, I suspect investors and traders in gold and silver to the long side are going to be disappointed, because remember, gold and all other commodities are traded in U.S. dollars. As the dollar strengthens, there is a tremendous headwind for gold, silver, and the related miners and the commodities complex. And they tend to feel the heat. And on top of that, if you have rising interest rates, and already if you look at the 10-year yield and the 30-year treasury yield in the U.S., it has spiked in the last 3 or 4 months. So if the Fed fund rate starts increasing over the course of this, say, in the next 12 to 18 months, if the Fed comes in and starts raising short-term interest rates and the bond yields also tend to go higher, then that will be very negative for gold and silver. So I think investors need to be careful here of owning gold and silver. From my perspective, I don't trade my opinion, I trade the price action. And if, as I said to you earlier, I'm not a diehard gold bear now, all I'm saying is that if prices show the positive confirmation and if prices go back above those overhead resistance levels, I would buy it. I don't mind paying a higher price, but I don't want to be wrong and I don't want to be caught in a multi-year bear market.
The housing market is in dire shape as far as I'm concerned. You have the HGX housing market, which I think is the best proxy for the sector, rolling over in one of the most frightening head and shoulders patterns I've seen in some time. Yes, we're having a relief rally this week. Add the housing, sluggish housing starts there, some of the worst on record. The trend is down on housing starts. And then, of course, as we know, housing, at least in the last 5 to 6 years, has been highly correlated with the precious metals sector. Therefore, if housing does roll over, we're likely to see even further strength in this rebound in the precious metals. As for your U.S. dollar thesis, in the past 3 years, the U.S. dollar has been in a quagmire. I'll grant you it's similar to the housing sector before it took off, like we've seen in the last 12 to 18 months. Nothing but year after year from the deflationists and the bears that the dollar was going to enter this massive rebound rally. And to me, it's beginning to resemble, at least from a technical perspective, a very bearish flag here. And also, you might take a look at the euro, which has a very similar pattern with regard to the interest rates. Of course, I believe that that was a huge component in the bear market raid we saw in the precious metals this year. As investors anticipated higher rates, of course, precious metals would suffer because that negative interest rate scenario that had been an underpinning in the precious metals for so long no longer holds. However, if the Fed even considers raising rates here, you would lose any chance whatsoever of reaching their 6.5% unemployment target rate. You would see 60, 70 million people or more on the food stamp rolls, and it would absolutely crush the vestiges of this nascent housing recovery that you alluded to.
Well, Chris, if you look at the U.S. dollar index, and I've got the weekly chart here in front of me, in April, May 2011, the U.S. dollar index was trading at 72.70. That was the low. Recently, it went to as high as 84.96, and now it's gone down a little bit to about 81.5. But if you see the price action over the last 2.5 years, the U.S. dollar index has made a series of higher highs and higher lows, and that is a definition of an uptrend. Conversely, if you look at gold and silver, they have been in pervasive downtrends for the last 18 months or 2 years, depending on whether you're talking about gold or silver, and they've made a series of lower highs and lower lows. So for me, if I look at the charts are telling me, and I don't really know why this is happening, but I do know that money is going back into stocks, money is going back into the U.S. dollar, money has been coming out of gold and silver, and this is just the reality. I mean, the opinions can be wrong. You know, I can be wrong, you can be wrong, gold bugs, gold bears, anybody can be wrong. But the price never lies, and the charts tell us that the trend reversed in 2011. Now, I'm not saying that gold and silver may not spike again. They may very well do if there is some policy decision by one of the big central banks about doing something crazy, then for sure gold and silver could spike again. But as things stand today, and based on the history over the last 2 years or so, the trend is not in favor of precious metals or commodities. People who have held precious metals, all commodities over the last 18 months or 2 years have experienced tremendous pain. The place to be today is to go long U.S. stocks and buy American housing. I have a different view on housing as you. I think housing has bottomed out. If you look at prices in California, even you look at some of the places in Las Vegas, and we are active in the real estate market. We have been recommending our clients to buy physical real estate in the U.S., and they've all made money over the last 12 to 18 months. So housing, in my view, has bottomed out. If you look at the Robert K. Shiller Index, that index is now basically bounced along the lows, and housing is picking up again. And housing is a long cycle. You know, it doesn't sort of go up and down very easily. And when it moves in one direction, it tends to stay put for a few years. So I think that housing is bottoming out and things are getting better in the U.S., not worse.
I didn't mean to suggest that the end of the housing market was at hand. We were also advising our subscribers to get heavily weighted with the REITs and real estate sector for at least the last 12 months, and those stocks have done remarkably well, most of which have a 9 to 15, so actually one had a 17% dividend yield. So no, I agree with you. There are certainly trading opportunities. I wonder if our time horizons match up here. That might be part of the divergence that we're facing. But turning to the U.S. dollar, I will concede that we have had a bounce here, stemming from around the gold market peak in, let's say, March of 2011. And there has been some higher highs and higher lows. But still, all in all, we're lower than we were 3 years ago.
No, of course we were. Of course we are lower than 3 years ago. I agree with you. But the point is, I'm saying that the dollar bottomed out in spring 2011, and that, in my view, was also the top for precious metals as well as commodities.
I realize that the energy market is its own beast, if you will. West Texas Intermediate crude nearing highs here, and you might recall that it was energy that led us into one of the super spike that we saw in the precious metals, and then it topped out and started to roll over, and the precious metals took off to the races. Not to suggest that history will repeat here, tensions in the Middle East with Syria and the West. The commodity market was truly dead. If this bull was finished, I would have expected to see the U.S. dollar taking off, not approaching, 3 year highs here in crude. To me, it looks as though we're facing a sea change. And all of the, as I said, speculative excesses unwinding, if you will, and we will soon see a resurgence in inflation concerns as well as in the safe havens.
I will have to see it to believe it personally. As I said, we don't pay too much attention on anybody's opinion, be it our own opinion, because I have learned from this business and from my painful experiences in the past that often you can be right and many times you're wrong. And one of those times when you are wrong, and if the price action goes against your own thesis, usually it pays to admit your mistake and move on. And I've seen that from my own experience. I've lost money in the past. I've made some mistakes like every other investor. And from my own trading style and investing style now, Chris, I pay most attention to the price because the price tells you what is happening, what millions of investors are doing with their cash. The price is never wrong. Opinions are wrong. I admit my opinion has been wrong in the past, and it will probably be wrong again in the future. And that's why I don't trade off my opinion. I trade on price. If you are right, if there is a resurgence of inflation, if prices do spike again, believe me, I will be back on board, and I will be riding the uptrend profitably. But for that to happen, I would need to see the overhead resistance levels cleared. If they clear it, I will allocate money back to gold and silver. I will buy the miners again. But until all the metals as well as the related miners are trading significantly lower than those resistance levels and there is tremendous overhead resistance and the trends are down, I'm not a buyer. I don't buy the dips, Chris. I buy the strength.
Oh, I think it's an excellent policy. It's certainly one that I've adhered to for at least a decade to stick with the trends. I mean, I think that's just a well-known axiom. Another thing I would allude to or point to is the commodities index. You may have noticed that it appears we've put in a double bottom there in the Reuters CRB index, another positive sign for a potential rebound.
I happen to believe that money is flowing back into productive assets, into stocks and real estate, which are cash flow generating assets. Money, the fear money, which was parked in gold and silver out of fear, has left gold and silver. The big money is going back into productive assets, and that is a fundamental story. I'm not saying that this is technical analysis. I'm just trying to explain or justify why I think this is happening now. I may be right or wrong. Nobody really knows. But the way I see it, the stock market in the U.S. is at a multi-year high. The Nasdaq yesterday closed at a 13-year high. That, to me, tells me that investors, rightly or wrongly, have been buying American stocks. And that's why money is going back into productive assets. People are not as afraid as they were 2 years ago. And I don't agree with the central bank's backstop intervention and all this QE nonsense, but we have to operate in the world in which we live. And for whatever reason, investors have decided that the world is not looking as bad as it was 2 years ago, and money is going back into productive assets. And I think this is the real reason why money has been coming out of precious metals and commodities. And I believe that the hyperinflationist view of the world is incorrect. People were wrong about its hyperinflation, and that's why, on a fundamental level, money has been coming out of gold and silver, because more and more investors are realizing that there is no hyperinflation coming, and their money is not really making anything in terms of yield in gold and silver, and money is basically going up in value in the stock market. So people are coming out of gold and silver and other commodities, other hard assets, and they're going back into productive assets. And I think that's the fundamental wrap.
From my viewpoint, we are looking at an economy and we are looking at markets such as the NASDAQ, which incidentally we've also been recommending to all of our subscribers for about 2 years, almost consecutively now, is almost a knee-jerk-like reaction to 10, 12 years of the fear that you alluded to. But just because you have a pause in momentum, just because the ontology has shifted somewhat, you don't just toss out the model. I believe we are in the greatest hyperinflationary episode that mankind has ever seen before. And I think if we really went through the nuts and bolts of this together, you would agree that at least the possibility of such a scenario is here. I think the stage is being set for extreme tension between Russia, China, and the United States and several other of the BRIC nations. War is incredibly inflationary. I think the oil market has caught at least a whiff of that. I can't think of a better time to pick up precious metals that are on sale, but I think in the final analysis, you are correct, and I agree with you, that the price will be the ultimate determinant. However, I like to be a value investor, and when I see something as valuable as gold and silver at these fire sale levels, and I see what appears to be a solid tradable bottom in place, to me, that's an opportunity. That's not a time to be shorting.
I'm not actually short any of the metals, Chris. I'm just long U.S. stocks, heavily long the stock market. I don't really have any position for the first time in many years in any of the hard assets or commodities or precious metals. And, you know, if precious metals get better and if commodities get better and if we have higher highs and higher lows and things seem to be turning around, then, as I mentioned, I will allocate some money back into commodities and precious metals. I'm only interested in making money and making a profit on the trading and the investing. I'm just saying that I don't know, and I think it's too early for me to decide that the trend has reversed for sure. For me, at this point, it looks more like a relief rally, but if prices take out the recent highs and then they go back above those resistance levels, then I would shift my camp and change my position and go long in gold and silver. But until then, I'm quite content with my exposure to the stock market, and I'm just watching the show on the sidelines.
You know, as we wind down, I would like to share a few of the top things that I would expect before we see the end of this bull market in gold and silver. And I believe we will see these things come to pass first. The Federal Reserve, the ECB, the BOJ, we will start to see them accumulate sizable gold. I think that is many years away because we're, of course, seeing central banks buy up gold, but none of the key banks yet. When we see 10% of investors have some exposure to precious metals, three sources I researched in recently show less than 3 to 5% of investors have any exposure, while equities exposure is well over 55 to 60%. We're going to need to see pension fund precious metals holdings soar from under half of 1% to at least 5% of their total holdings. And keep in mind that Japan has over $3 trillion alone in pension fund related assets, much of which unnerved recently by sovereign debt issues, and I expect that theme to persist for many years. And then, of course, a COMEX default. And lastly, I think the death knell for safe haven will occur when interest rates soar into double digits. But by then, I anticipate gold and silver will be many, many fold above their current prices.
For me, Chris, I have an opposite view as you from you, unfortunately, or I don't know who's right at this point. But I think that the bull market in gold and silver ended in 2011. And we are now in a multi-year secular downtrend. If you look at silver, silver is already down by, from peak to trough, it fell by over 60%. And I find it very hard to believe that a 60% smash in any market can be classified as a pause or a correction. If you remember in 2007, the S&P topped at around 1550, and then it fell to 666 in 2009 in March. And my gosh, that was classified as the worst smash in history, and that was an ultimate catastrophe. And that was only about 55-60%. So I don't really understand this viewpoint where a 55-60% smash is as a doomsday scenario, but if silver falls 60%, that is referred to as a pause or a correction in a multi-year secular uptrend. I believe that if anything falls by 50 or 60%, whether it is stocks or commodities or gold or silver, That to me is a clear signal that the party is over, that something else is at play here, the trend has reversed. So I would beg to differ with you. I think gold and silver are in a multi-year downtrend, and in my view, they are going to disappoint investors for the next 4 or 5 years.
Silver had just climbed from $17 to roughly $50. That's a threefold increase. So of course you're going to expect a 50 or to 60% retracement. Did we overshoot a little bit? Of course you're going to overshoot because it's a tiny fractional market. Just as you would expect silver to have a remarkable rebound as we've just seen, a 33% from peak to trough. I do agree with you. Were we to take out the recent lows, then your downtrend thesis comes into play and you can toss all the fundamentals out the window.
It is one of those rare instances, Chris, where we have different points of view and only time will tell whose view was correct. And I don't know whether I'm 100% correct or not, but for me, you know, to change my thesis, I would have to see, you know, better price action in both gold as well as silver. If it happens, then I'll go long again.
Very good. Well, I'm sure that you would agree, though, that with such volatility in the market, and that for investors who would like to improve the beta of their portfolios, there's very little other than maybe currency exposure, which is somewhat complex for the typical investor. There's very little that compares, I think, to commodities, and in particular, the precious metals. They have a tendency to have very low fractional betas in the neighborhood of, let's say, 50% or so. And that has a tendency to bring down some of those high beta stocks that folks like to accumulate. So if nothing else, every investor needs to have that insurance policy, but it's more than an insurance policy. As I said, it's a wonderful beta balancing technique. And for folks that are unaware, you know, that's just simply means that as one asset declines, the other tends to offset the decline. I really appreciate the lively discussion. Why don't you tell folks more about Peru Saxena Wealth Management, please?
Sure, Chris. The firm is based here in Hong Kong. We are regulated by the Securities and Futures Commission. We manage discretionary investment portfolios on behalf of investors. We follow a trend-following approach, so we don't try and predict. We don't try and make sense of it all. We simply take our guidance from the price action, and we follow trends and put stops under each position and protect the downside. So if we are wrong and if prices go the other way, then we have an exit policy and we try and minimize the damage by having a stringent stop loss or risk management system in place. And we operate on a fee basis. In addition to the money management service, we also publish a monthly report, some research for individual investors as well as corporate investors. And the research is called Money Matters, and this can be obtained from my website, which is www.perusaxena.com.
Thanks so much, Peru.
Thank you very much, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. One has to question the motives of Wall Street analysts when they come out in what appears to be uniform alliance against a company like Apple Computer and start telling the company how to innovate and what to innovate. A Wall Street Journal article titled, "Wall Street Gives Apple's New iPhones Thumbs Down," complains that the new multicolored 5C low-cost $99 iPhone isn't cheap enough for their tastes. A Credit Suisse analyst said, "So much for the low end," and downgraded the stock to neutral from a previous outperform rating. Credit Suisse says, "We remain disappointed with Apple's decision to remain a premium-priced smartphone vendor, and this continues to competitively expose the company." Oh, really? Phil Schiller, Apple's head of worldwide marketing, said, "This is our most forward-thinking phone yet. I must say I tend to favor Apple in this horse race. Apple has always been ahead of the curve. They have a history of advancing new technology and dropping familiar yet old technology before the market And especially the Wall Street analysts are ready for it. I remember in the 1990s another batch of Wall Street analysts who continually proclaimed Apple was all but dead time after time again. Even as Steve Jobs began reinventing the company and making huge strides, the analysts continued to present Apple as an inferior third cousin to Microsoft. The analysts were wrong, and in my opinion, they're wrong again. Wall Street telling Apple what kind of products to produce is like money managers telling a mine operator how big of a mill to build. The mining world is full of stories of companies that built mills that were oversized for a project, and the company ended up milling a lot of waste rock instead of a lot of ore. The more they milled, the more money they lost. That's what happens when companies listen to financiers instead of engineers. Despite the Wall Street rhetoric, Apple still knows where it's going. But a lot of companies and individuals do not. Many companies and many people live with one foot in the past and one foot in the future, instead of having a clear path going forward. Indecision is a killer. Either make the decision to live in the past or get on with your life and move forward. Don't stand with one foot on two separate ledges 12 inches apart. For a while, it can work. You can easily position yourself between both ledges as circumstances dictate. But eventually, rapid change will hit, and those ledges will start moving in opposite directions with a death-defying drop below you. When that happens, you had better know which direction you want to go, because no matter how comfortable it feels right now, it will become progressively more difficult to live with one foot in the past and one foot in the future. There will come a point where clarity of vision, clarity of where you want to go and what you want to achieve, will be your greatest survival skill. There will come a point in the not too distant future where, if you're not committed to planting both feet in either the past or the future, you may cease to exist in either. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.